This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's been another week of trouble here on planet Earth. Multiple cyclones hit Asia, plus Tropical Storm Whippa dumped so much water on the blown reactors at Fukushima, struggling utility owner TEPCO announced the highest radiation reading on record, 400,000 becquerels per liter, near one of their storage tanks. We were told that was all over, everything was under control. Down under in Australia, another fire season has hit earlier than ever, following that country's hottest year ever, and hottest September ever recorded. Naturally, the new Abbott government is doing all it can to dismantle every carbon control and climate change law in Australia. Nice work, fellas. Enjoy your hot new times.
Sometimes it's bad. Sometimes it makes me feel so sad.
But this week on Radio EcoShock, we are going way back to see the big future. Dr. Peter Ward explains the four past mass extinctions caused by global warming. Rutgers scientist Morgan Schaller talks about a startling new discovery. Around 55 million years ago, Earth warmed by 5 degrees centigrade or 9 Fahrenheit in just 13 years. That's what can happen. We wrap up with the struggle to stop this fossil fuel madness. Stephanie Goodwin from Greenpeace reports on the Arctic 30, the entire ship and crew seized by the Russian government and imprisoned for months, charged with piracy, if you can believe that. Their crime? Trying to bring your attention to the new wave of dangerous Arctic drilling. It's a packed show, and here we go.
Radio EcoShock.
Of the five great extinctions many people know, a meteor crashed into Earth, killing the dinosaurs. The other four were caused by global warming, a fact that hasn't penetrated the minds of the public or our legislators. Dr. Peter Ward is an expert on past climate and mass extinctions. He's an author, a researcher, paleontologist, and professor of biology and of Earth and Space Sciences at the University of Washington. Among his 14 books, we find recently, Under a Green Sky, Global Warming, The Mass Extinctions of the Past and What They Can Tell Us About Our Future, The Medea Hypothesis, Is Life on Earth Ultimately Self-Destructive, and The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps. Peter Ward, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having me.
Why don't we start with this? How do we know four past mass extinction events were caused by global warming and not something else like a meteor impact?
Well, we certainly have some very interesting geological evidence telling us about what carbon dioxide levels were in the past. We also have great fossil evidence. When the Earth is warmed, we get very different types of plants and animals. Obviously, now we find a very different set of animals and plants at the tropics than we do at the poles. So we see that there's a tremendous correlation between times of high carbon dioxide as well as high numbers of animals and plants. And then we have a further moment in Earth history when it's not just high carbon dioxide, but it suddenly spurts upward to extremely high levels. And at that same time, the fossil record, it shows coincident mass extinctions. The correlation between very short-term high warming and mass extinction has now been confirmed over and over and over and over to the point that it is a hypothesis that can now be elevated to a theory.
Well, can you run us through the process from excess carbon dioxide to a warmer world and then the killer gas that you've talked about?
It turns out that as the world warms, the tropics are about as hot as they can get. They can only warm up a little bit more because of a series of laws of physics, which I can't explain, but is pretty clear. The tropics aren't going to go up 20 degrees Fahrenheit, let's say. But we know that the Arctic can and does and is. And we know, for instance, that we've got far more relative warming in the number of degrees of temperature that an area is heating in the high latitudes than the low or even the mid latitudes to some extent. This is why all the Arctic ice is melting. And this is why almost every article you read about global warming is dealing with the Arctic, the Antarctic. But you're not hearing things about, oh, gee, the tropics went up by 20 degrees. It doesn't happen. So when we have a really warming set of poles and a tropics which stays the same, the heat differential, the difference in temperature between the tropical regions and the Arctic regions reduces. That heat differential is what causes there to be weather, what causes there to be the redistribution of heat, which produces air currents and, most importantly, water currents. As the poles warm and the tropics don't, the world gets uniform in temperature, and with the uniform temperature, down go currents, down goes the wind, and what we start getting is stagnation. Just like you have a pond which, sitting in the warm without any sort of wind, will very rapidly turn stagnant, so too do the world's oceans become stagnant. And if they do, they lose their oxygen, just as a pond does. And a pond that is filled with rotting vegetation very quickly starts producing bubbles of gas. You can smell something. We call it swamp gas. It is a series of rotting vegetation, rotting animals, rotting organisms that are being decayed. And we find a whole new set of bacteria generally use up all of the oxygen within that pond. And then a different set of bacteria take over, which produce the very toxic gas called hydrogen sulfide. So much of what we call swamp gas, sometimes methane, but quite often this rotting egg smell is hydrogen sulfide. So let's pretend that the world is just like one giant pond where the whole thing has gone stagnant. The same principles apply, but on a global scale.
This hypothesis that hydrogen sulfide likely killed off land animals, especially mammals, how did that idea develop? Who did originate that?
There's some really interesting work about hydrogen sulfide taking place all over the planet right now in many scientific laboratories. More and more we're finding that this is an amazing gas for better and for worse. We've been studying it for a long time, the worst sides of it. Those who are dealing with groundwater, those who are drilling wells, quite often can encounter pockets of hydrogen sulfide, and it can kill the weller. So what we're looking more and more now are companies that are using meters to try to recognize when they're finding pockets of hydrogen sulfide. Well, just knowing that that gas had such a deleterious effect and is so poisonous led many researchers to begin looking at it. And like many things in high quantity which are poisonous, in fact, in very small quantities, there's a beneficial side to it. This is how many of our really excellent medical chemicals were discovered. For instance, the terrible poison used by the old South American Indians called curare, where they would put it on their arrows, that is now in small quantities called Coumadin. This is one of the most widely prescribed medicines in the world. It's a blood thinner. After operations, you're routinely given this stuff. Hydrogen sulfide in low dose is a very beneficial aspect. And so research into it, much of it taking place at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Institute in Seattle by a guy named Mark Roth. Mark started looking at hydrogen sulfide as a way of putting mammals into suspended animation. But he found at the same time that mammals are much more susceptible to hydrogen sulfide than our reptiles. And furthermore, he discovers that warm-blooded creatures such as we really are susceptible to this stuff, whereas reptiles, any cold bloods, cold-blooded invertebrates, have a much higher tolerance because hydrogen sulfide works on our metabolism in such a way that it essentially knocks out our ability to remain endothermic or warm-blooded. The mass extinctions in the past, the land animals, the biggest of all, the Permian extinction, shows just this pattern. Those animals which were cold-blooded, the reptiles, survived virtually untouched, where the earliest mammals, called mammal-like reptiles, still were warm-blooded. These are the creatures that died out in droves. So we had this selective extinction, and it really looks like that hydrogen sulfide did it.
Well, someone asked me about the sea life that produces hydrogen sulfide, and I couldn't explain it properly. What species does this?
There are lots and lots of bacteria that do it. The bacteria that produce this are, just as we use oxygen to respire, many other types of bacteria use sulfur, and they essentially breathe in sulfur, change it chemically, and exhale hydrogen sulfide. It's just as we exhale carbon dioxide, many bacteria exhale hydrogen sulfide. It's a waste product to get rid of it. And just as too much carbon dioxide will kill us, a lot of hydrogen sulfide can affect many kinds of bacteria. So you have to have very special conditions to have these microbes, which are sulfur breathers, and there has to be absolutely no oxygen around. They can only live on seawater or in ponds that all oxygen, all free oxygen has been used up or has otherwise disappeared. So this is where the conditions have to be such that you can produce all over the ocean bottoms a lack of oxygen. And once that happens, these bacteria, which really are everywhere around us, you simply need to go to any beach and dig down about 2 or 3 or 4 inches in some cases. You find a black layer, pick it up, smell it, and you just get this awful rotten egg smell. It's the hydrogen sulfide producing bacteria that even 3 or 4 inches beneath our nice oxygenated beaches are sitting there. So you don't have to go very far down into the earth, essentially, to find these bacteria. And if the oceans become zero oxygen all over, they just take over in huge numbers, and great quantities of hydrogen sulfide are produced.
I've just interviewed the marine biologist from the UK, Alex Rogers, about the State of the Oceans 2013 report, and he says the oceans are already losing oxygen, especially in parts of the North Atlantic and most of the tropics. Are we headed into green sky conditions?
Oh, absolutely. Just all we need to do is just keep pumping CO2 into the atmosphere, and there we go. The great Lee Kump of Penn State was, even several years ago, was looking at the model suggesting how quickly will this take place. And the Pacific Ocean, for the first time, is now viewed as losing its deep water oxygen. It takes a long time. It's not going to happen in our lifetimes, probably not in the next few generations, but if we keep producing the amount of carbon dioxide that we do, causing this differential in the temperature of the high latitudes, Arctic and the tropics, to keep reducing, and that's what we're doing. The Arctic is getting warmer every year. The tropics aren't. We reduce the amount of oxygen, which makes it to the sea bottom, and you start this process, and we have started this process.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with Dr. Peter Ward. Peter, I've seen science-based videos which explain frozen methane under the sea, the clathrates, were released by warming oceans to cause extreme climate change. I'm surprised you didn't mention these at all. Why not?
The clathrates, actually, it's a fascinating subject. What we don't know is exactly how much quantity of clathrates is there. Are these unto themselves sufficient to have produced the warming that you need? What's going on with clathrates, of course, is you get a positive feedback. Clathrates stay frozen in place until you warm them, and the higher latitude you go, the colder it is, the more the clathrates are stable. Well, if we say melt clathrates at a 60-degree latitude and it warms up a little bit, well, then we can perhaps the next year melt the clathrates, which are a little bit further north and on. So this is what we call a positive feedback. The warmer it gets, the warmer it gets. But the clathrates themselves probably are not sufficient. Even if we got all of the clathrates out of the various systems to lead to the catastrophes that we've seen in the past, there has to be some other external force. And in the past, each time it has been a major volcanic event that we call flood basalts. And the flood basalts, believe me, they cause the warming, and then the clathrates can add in. But I don't think the clathrates alone are part of it. And so, again, what we can say is that the extraordinary volcanic activity this time aren't volcanoes, but it is human industry.
Well, I want to talk to you about that because, you know, I have a science alert service, and last July there was an announcement that British scientists have studied James Lovelock's Gaia theory, that life more or less purposefully changes the Earth to suit its own survival. And they found science could not back that up. But you already did that work several years previously in your book, The Medea Hypothesis. Briefly, who was Medea and what is that hypothesis?
Medea was Jason's wife. If we're going to use Gaia, which is the Greek for good mother, I just took my tongue firmly in cheek and say, well, let's use what the bad mother is. And in Jason and the Golden Fleece myth, Jason went off to go after this Don Quixote-like task of finding the Golden Fleece. And to do that, he fell in love, or he got the daughter of the king who owned the fleece to fall in love with him. Jason turned out to be a very bad husband, and in very great distress, his wife murders their children, making her, at least in Greek mythology, the worst mother of all time. Too much life is the cause of many of the mass extinctions. We're just talking about the formation of hydrogen sulfide. that it takes bacteria to do it. This is life producing a gas which led at least 4 to 5 times to the destruction of over half of all species. That's not very Gaian, if you ask me.
But you've said that these mass extinctions were really triggered by a geological event, namely the eruption of mass amounts of lava from volcanoes. Surely we can't attribute that to a suicidal urge in living things.
No, but certainly what did cause the poison itself was being produced by the bacteria. I mean, you could have all the volcanic stuff in the world, but it took the addition of these hydrogen sulfide producing microbes to actually bring the actual kill mechanism. This is what the missing element was for so long. Things get warmer, things get colder, but how could such mass death take place? I mean, that was where, gosh, there's something really, really missing about this. I mean, you might say that, gee, uranium sits around. It doesn't do anything to anybody. How could we say that uranium is involved in an atomic weaponry? Well, it took the humans to put the uranium into its little state of explosiveness. And so in the same sort of way, the warming simply opens up the world for the microbes to do the coup de grace.
Well, moving forward in your books, you say rising seas are the single greatest problem of climate change. I had inner objections when I heard that. What about the impacts of violent storms and the loss of agricultural production with heating? Why are rising seas number one?
Well, I think rising seas themselves are going to affect agriculture in such a negative way. Yes, you're going to have the effects on agriculture from other aspects, but the rising seas themselves, I think, are the shortest term, most dangerous process that will affect, I think, global politics. You only have to raise the oceans by, say, 2 meters to have an enormously deleterious effect on even just rice alone. Much of rice is farmed at very low elevations, as we know. It's right next to the ocean in most cases. And the single most productive agricultural sites on Earth are deltas. I mean, the great Asian deltas, the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, the Mekong, each of these enormous low areas where rice is grown in enormous quantities. We look at the delta that takes place around the India subcontinent. Bangladesh, for instance, feeds itself. It has an enormous population, but feeds itself because of 4 crops per year. We often have 2, but they have 4. And yet, if we have a 6-foot sea level rise, about 50% of Bangladesh food production disappears. It's not that it just gets covered with seawater, but saltwater goes sideways, and you don't have to have the sea actually covering a field to ruin the field. When you look forward at what might be the agricultural production with a 6-foot sea level rise, and until recently the IPCC was saying that we could expect to have a 4-foot sea level rise by 2100, people are bandying that around. But if it doesn't happen by 2100, certainly by 2150, you're going to have a 6-foot sea level rise. What happens to those fields and how do we replace those fields and all the people that they feed? This is going to be a really rapid change when we have a burgeoning human population. So this is where I think geopolitically it's going to affect the poorest nations on Earth at the highest level and with the greatest disaster.
In your Edmonds College talk last April, you made some extreme statements. For example, you said, don't spend money on Galveston, Texas, and just plain, quote, get out of South Florida. You're going to upset some people there. Why say that?
Well, if you take the long view, Galveston, Texas, South Florida, many of these areas are going to be inundated. Look at what New Jersey is doing. We get the global warming spawn storm, Hurricane Sandy last year. It wipes out, it knocks down all of the New Jersey amusement parks, the waterfront, such. They just rebuild it right back up in the same place. How many times do you have to have this stuff knocked down before you realize, gee, maybe we shouldn't be putting that money back into it? The areas that really, I think, are going to really affect us most strongly, most of the world's airports, in many respects, are at sea level. You find airports everywhere along the coasts of the continents. Countries that can build airports out into the ocean. San Francisco did this. Japan does this. China did it. Honolulu. It's just a number of airports I've landed in Sydney where you're just skimming the ocean and then you're on this tarmac. All of those are going to get covered over by even a 3 to 5 foot sea level rise because of storm surge. you have to rebuild them. It's the amount of money we're going to have to do to just to move stuff inland, and we'll keep doing it over and over and over. So this, to me, is the economic problem that's facing us from sea level rise.
Well, I agree with you, but, you know, Professor Emeritus Guy McPherson concludes that maybe humans will become extinct before the year 2100 due to climate change, and yet you're talking about rebuilding airports away from the sea. Why do you assume we will survive and continue as a civilization, even if we get a 4 to 8 degree C heating event, if that's possible?
I don't see how anyone could say we'll be extinct by 2100. We have the technology. We're so capable of saving ourselves. Happy, maybe not, but safe, yes. It's always been my sense that, in fact, humans might be the most extinction-proof of all species because of our technical ability, because of ultimately we can build a gas mask, which almost nothing else can do. No, we're going to be here, but we're going to be here in increasingly isolated company compared to wildlife that's around us and the biodiversity. But no, I think we're going to muddle through just fine.
This is Radio EcoShock with Dr. Peter Ward as our guest. Peter, we all know climate denial flourishes in Congress and in the public mind. You blamed high school teaching and especially the university system. Please tell us about that.
The culture at the university is that what you want in a young faculty member, a young scientist that is in a science faculty, is to publish great scientific papers. Research is number one. Number two can be teaching. Number three, service to the university. And number four, outreach to the public. It is really in that order. Anybody who thinks otherwise, really, you need to know this is the truth. The better the university, the less interest there is in what we call outreach. And in outreach, I'm talking about communication, science communication, that which leads to science literacy. The great scientific universities are aiding and abetting science illiteracy by making no call, no requirement of their young faculty moving up to change, to do something about this, to not write a paper for Science or Nature and instead do one for Scientific American. Go on a TV show. Put as much effort into that scientific study and try to make it into a science for the public study. So there is no push for this because the universities need government money. They need the big science grants, and science grants go for published articles. They don't go for articles for the public. This is this enormous disconnect. It's what the public believes and what the science universities believe. And once you have a culture where your young people don't have to do it, they rise through time, and then they're the powers. Well, we didn't have to do it, so we're going to just keep this going. It's self-perpetuating. It's a travesty.
When we talk about solutions, you have a low opinion about physicist Paul Crutzen's proposal to spray sulfur aerosols from airplanes to cool off the planet. How do you know the resulting acid rain would kill off lots of life on Earth?
Well, one never knows. I mean, this is a case, maybe he's totally correct. But certainly all we have to do is look at what happened to Canada in the 1960s and 1970s with the American power plants and all the coal-fired power plants in the American Midwest and much of that pollution moving up into the beautiful Ontario lakes. There's clearly a very bad side effect of having sulfur particles coming out of these power plants, landing in fresh water, and creating increased acidity. I mean, it is a very anti-life type of chemical work. So Crutzen is just saying the same thing, is that we're going to put the same types of particles that come out of these coal-fired plants, except we'll put them all over in the atmospheres. How could there not be resulting acid rain coming from this? He's won the Nobel Prize. I haven't. He must be right. But common sense suggests he's not.
Practically, the only optimism I've heard from you lately is that we may not have to lose all the ice caps totally. Why not?
Well, there's a lot of interesting information coming out now that more and more it may be that in the Cretaceous, even 65 million years ago, in the Cretaceous at the time when the dinosaurs died out, the very end of it, there may have been some ice sheets. There may have been ice on the planet when carbon dioxide reached about 1,000 parts per million. This is a very hotly debated subject right now. It's intensively being researched. The answer isn't there yet, but it gives me hope if we can find out that we could have 1,000 parts per million. For instance, we're at 400 now. If we could have 1,000 parts per million and still have some ice, the fact that at 1,000 maybe all the ice doesn't melt, this certainly is going to ameliorate the catastrophe that I see by causing, say, 240 feet of sea level rise all over the planet when you lose all the ice. So maybe the catastrophe won't be quite as bad as we thought. But who's to say it's going to stop at 1,000 parts per million? If we keep industrialized civilization going, we could easily push it up to 2,000 parts per million, and then we really, clearly, are not going to have any ice at all.
Do you have a new book or research project you're working on that you'd like to tell us about?
Yeah, I have a book coming out in April. It's called A New History of Life. I tried to take, with my colleague Joe Kirschfink at Caltech, we tried to put together all the new crackpot ideas about how life started on this planet, about its early evolution, about some of the aspects of atmosphere. It's really a book about atmosphere, asking, as oxygen levels go up and down, as carbon dioxide levels go up and down, what can it tell us about how the evolution of plants and animals on this planet changed? So it's pretty long, 135,000 words, and we're right now fighting over the editing, but that's the project that will be out next.
We've been talking with Dr. Peter Ward, a paleontologist at the University of Washington and author of more than a dozen books. Find links to his work and our previous Radio EcoShock interviews in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Peter, as always, I want to thank you not just for your time now, but for your outspoken bravery always. We need it.
Well, thank you, but more than we need people like me, we need people like you, because you are the conscience of this planet, and there's people like you that actually give me the hope to keep going. So I want to thank you, Alex.
You're making me blush. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. What would happen if world temperatures jumped 5 degrees centigrade, 9 degrees Fahrenheit, in just 13 years? Impossible, says mainstream science. But a new paper published this September in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences shows a rapid wild heating event struck before on this planet 55 million years ago. Could it happen again? Our guest, Dr. Morgan F. Schaller, is from the Wright Labs at the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Along with James Wright, Morgan is co-author of the paper, Evidence for a Rapid Release of Carbon at the Paleocene-Eocene Thermal Maximum. Morgan Schaller, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me on here.
Well, it's good that you called. Thank you. Let's start with this. Briefly, what is the Paleocene-Eocene Thermal Maximum, or PETM?
So this is an event at the Paleocene-Eocene boundary, which is just a geologic boundary that corresponds to a massive increase in atmospheric CO2, along with about a 5 degrees C global warming. And it really wasn't very well understood how fast this thing occurred, but I think we put some numbers on it now in this new paper.
So how would you characterize the importance of the discovery made by your team?
It's definitely very important to the circumstances of this particular event. And it definitely has implications for what we're doing today and maybe the rate of carbon release that we're doing today.
Well, how did you and James Wright uncover this ancient heat signal?
These are a series of sediment cores where we made this discovery. And these are basically long cylinders of muds and silts from the coastal plain, on the Atlantic coastal plain. And Jim Wright was helping a colleague process these cores, split them in their two halves. And what he noticed was that there were these really remarkably rhythmic couplets in this particular clay unit that contains this PETM event, this massive carbon perturbation event. And when he sort of called me over and showed them to me, I said, you know, really, these have got to mean something. And as geologists, whenever we see features like that, we sort of start looking for mechanisms that can account for them. And in this case, we made some oxygen isotope measurements that tell you something about temperature changes. And we found that in the stuff preserved within each one of these little clay cycles, about 2 centimeter thick clay cycles, there was a temperature cycle associated with each one. And for a variety of reasons, we concluded that each clay couplet represents an annual depositional cycle. So if these cycles are due to the seasonal climate cycle on the continental shelf, then the carbon isotope excursion and that's that massive release of CO2 to the atmosphere that is recorded by those sediments, we now have a very accurate timescale for the release of that carbon. So, and what we found was that the CO2 was released nearly instantaneously, appears to be within one of these clay couplets, or about 1 year. And then over a series of about a decade, the surface waters, the ocean surface waters went acidic, and there was about a 5 degrees C warming.
And you calculated, it says, that it would take about 3,000 gigatons of carbon to create this massive heating event. That sounds close to what I've seen as the mass of carbon in the atmosphere right now. What could have caused such a huge, fast carbon burst?
The mass of carbon that was really roughly about 3,000 gigatons. And at the time, there would have been about 2,000 gigatons in the atmosphere. Our atmosphere today has about 800 gigatons of carbon, a little bit less than that. So they are a little bit different. But the possible triggers for this event in the Paleocene, I mean, there have been a whole lot of causes sort of tossed out there. But as it stands, the very best explanation for this carbon release is a comet impact. And there is some evidence in these sediments and other places that there was, in fact, some kind of impact at this time.
It had to happen really, really fast for what you found, yeah.
Yeah, and we can exclude things like methane that has something like a 10-year residence time in the atmosphere, things like that.
And what do we know about what happened on Earth during and immediately after such a steep temperature change? Were there extinctions, changes in ecosystems, changes in the oceans? Do we know what happened?
We have a fairly good idea of, I mean, sort of the global picture of what happened after this event. I mean, we know that at least in the oceans, there was about a 5 degrees C change in temperature, increase in temperature. And that was most certainly global. But there were no really significant extinctions. Some bottom water living organisms had a tough time, but that's about it. But after this massive release of carbon, there is evidence for acidification of the oceans. And there's evidence from ocean sediments and from a variety of other means that there was an acidification coincident with the global warming. And we do know that there were changes in temperature and humidity on land, specifically in the continental interiors. Things seemed to get drier, and maybe on the coast, things got a lot wetter. Some of those specific effects are not very clear.
I did read one article that the Smithsonian was doing research in Wyoming where they found that plants had moved up, so that they had plants there that you might have found in a South Carolina swamp for a while after this PETM event.
Right. And they moved up, I think they moved both northward and up in altitude. Presumably that is a response to an increase in temperature. So there are some pretty clear responses to things on land during this time. We know that there was a significant aridification. And that's a great section out in Wyoming that shows some of the best evidence of changes on land concurrent with this event.
Well, let's talk about how this Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum carbon release would compare to what humans are emitting now. Can you tell us that?
Sure. What we're doing now, well, first, what we found is that the carbon release at this event was much faster than what we're doing now. Previous estimates on the rates really were all over the place and not very precise. And for that reason, it was used as an analog for what we're doing today. But what we've shown is that it was much faster than what we're doing today by a long shot. But a not insignificant finding is that we've really confirmed that there is a positive temperature response to a CO2 release. And what we've done, what happened in this event was something like a 2.5 times increase in CO2 in the atmosphere. So, you know, a little bit over a doubling, maybe a doubling and a half, which resulted in about 5 degrees C of global warming. And that's been demonstrated numerous times. We've done a good job confirming that this massive release, a single release, did coincide with a big increase in temperature, which is significant. But with a single fast release scenario like this, it actually makes things quite simple to understand. And that's because we've added the carbon to the atmosphere in an almost instantaneous way, whereas what we're doing now is extremely slow. Well, not extremely slow, but relatively slow compared to an instantaneous perturbation. I was searching for the right analogy for this, why this might be significant, but you can think of this like a little kid jumping in a mud puddle. If he jumps directly into the water, all the water goes flying out of the mud puddle, and if he hops out immediately, he doesn't get very wet. However, if he sort of walk slowly into the mud puddle. All the water has time to absorb into his shoes and his socks and soak up his pant legs, and he'll get completely drenched. So what we're doing now is releasing carbon at a rate of something like 8 gigatons per year, which is equivalent to walking very slowly into that puddle. If we compare that to the PETM, we were releasing something like 3,000 gigatons almost within 1 year. So very different rates.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking about new science on a rapid warming of the Earth 55 million years ago and what it might mean for our future. Our guest is Dr. Morgan Schaller from Rutgers University. Well, the Earth was a different place at that time. The continents were different. Antarctica, I believe, was attached to South America, was it not? So could you talk a little bit more about the similarities and differences from those times to now?
Sure. I think one of the biggest differences between then and now, at least from a climate perspective, was that now we have a substantial amount of ice on the continents, Greenland, Antarctica, whereas during the Eocene, this is 56 million years ago, there was hardly any ice on the continents at all. So that in itself makes the response of the climate system to any kind of perturbation very different. So, for example, if we were to release this amount of carbon that we're suggesting happened at the PETM within a year now, we would probably see a pretty dramatic response from the ice sheets, an increase in sea level and that kind of thing, whereas during the Eocene, that effect would not have been in place. And there are other things along those lines that are a little bit different. Continental configurations were obviously a little bit different. Ocean circulation was a little bit different. But by and large, things were actually pretty similar to what they are today. It was just substantially warmer on land and in the oceans overall before the event.
So the ice, I would think, would act a little bit like a set of brakes on a car compared to what they had then. Would I be right in that?
Sort of. The ice would be a big player, for sure. Ice causes changes in the climate system that, like albedo and things like that, that is reflecting coming radiation back out to space that would not have been in play during the PETM. So there are some estimates that say at the PETM, we would actually expect to see a little bit more warming per doubling of CO2 than we would observe now because of the reflectance that the ice sheets are causing during current times. But the analogy is a little bit more difficult because this was released so quickly at this event.
For this new paper, you had Wallace Broker, Wally Broker, the person who popularized the term global warming, as the editor. How was it working with the man called the Dean of Climate Science?
I mean, he's a great guy and really, really has an eye for separating those truly significant observations from the less meaningful ones. When we gave this talk at Columbia, he immediately recognized the potential significance of these findings, which was really sort of a breath of fresh air because it's met some resistance from some people that are a little more entrenched in a different way of thinking. And he also sort of immediately recognized that this piece of work needed to be evaluated in peer review by highly qualified people who simply have no career investment in this event to remove the possibility of bias, which was really, that was an amazing extension of himself there.
Is that talk at Columbia available anywhere online, or was it recorded?
I don't believe so, no.
Okay. Now, Morgan Schaller, what are other scientists saying about this discovery? Have doubts been expressed?
Sure, and there will always be skepticism, and I take that as a very good thing. It's healthy, and I would be concerned if there was no skepticism around our findings. But really, the most people without any attachment to this event, that haven't spent a significant amount of their career looking at this thing, see our results as sort of a breath of fresh air. Now we can start to learn some more things from what happened 55 million years ago. And most of the real vocal people against this idea, or at least that express severe doubts about this finding, have sort of an academic career investment in other scenarios.
Well, one of my concerns would be climate models. I wonder if they could pick up such a rapid event in the past, and if not, could they pick up a rapid climate shift in the future? So are these climate theories and models going to have to be adjusted, do you think?
Two things actually in there. First of all, I don't think any climate model would ever be able to predict this event. If it indeed was due to a comet, which, that certainly has not been settled, but if that were the case, a climate model would never be able to predict something like that. And I don't think that any model would be able to predict such a rapid change using normal climate dynamics ever. But if you prescribe such a rapid change, the models do a very good job of describing the response of each individual system to that increase in CO2. And what we've done in this paper actually, it really helps out some of those models, because now they have a very precise timescale of the carbon released. So whereas before they had to use a range of timescales and it was really unclear how fast this event happened. But there's a lot of work with these models that show pretty convincingly that there's a 100,000-year sort of fall off response to, or 200,000-year or so fall off response of this CO2 perturbation working its way through all of Earth's exchangeable carbon reservoirs. And a lot of that science is going to remain basically unchanged. If anything, it'll be much more precise now that we know exactly how quickly this thing happened.
Morgan, will you be doing follow-up research, and are you working on a new project?
Oh, I've got several things going on now, but I'm looking at the next kind of thing on the docket is to look at ocean acidification as recorded by corals. And specifically, I'm going to be looking at what's happening at this event across a couple coral sequences. Corals are surface water animals that also have a photosynthetic guy living with them, and they show very profound responses to ocean acidification as well as ocean warming. So it would be really interesting to get a good handle on the exact chemical, ocean chemistry changes that are recorded within corals that survive through this event. That's one direction I'm really pushing hard on right now.
What is the takeaway for listeners about what this discovery says about the possibility of a rapid climate shift triggered by our own emissions?
Well, in some ways, this event has always been an imperfect analogy to what we're doing now. Certainly, if a rapid release of carbon, like the scenario for the PETM, were to happen today, the consequences would be very different. There would probably be a very profound response from the glaciers and from ice sheets, which means there would probably be a pretty rapid increase in sea levels and things like that. But in the Eocene, there was no substantial ice on land, so we don't really have an analogy for those effects. But what we have done is shown that there is an unequivocal temperature response to a little over a doubling of atmospheric CO2. And we've added a very precise timescale to those observations. So, like I said, the PETM was much faster, and what we're doing now is about 8 gigatons of carbon per year versus at the PETM, you know, we're looking at something like 3,000 gigatons per year. So I think there are a lot of things we can learn from this event that are potentially in our future, but I think what we're doing right now may in some ways be a little more dangerous, because we're releasing carbon at such a rate that all those slower acting carbon reservoirs exchange on much longer timescales. We're releasing carbon so that those reservoirs can become active and absorb this perturbation that we're creating in a much more equilibrium way, such that we're sort of fundamentally shifting our climate state, whereas at the PETM, we basically immediately perturbed an already equilibrium climate state, which is a very different thing. So if we go back to the analogy of a kid jumping in a puddle, what we're doing right now is essentially as if we were walking very slowly into that puddle, and the water is able to absorb into all of the active water-absorbing reservoirs on our body, which would be analogous to those carbon reservoirs. Whereas if we do this thing extremely quickly, like we're suggesting nearly instantaneously, as happened at the PETM, it has much less long-term permanent effects, at least I would argue.
You've been listening to Dr. Morgan F. Schaller from the Wright Labs at Rutgers University in New Jersey. We've been discussing his new co-authored paper, Evidence for a Rapid Release of Carbon at the Paleocene-Eocene Thermal Maximum. It reveals a rapid increase in global temperature in just 13 years. Morgan, thank you for contributing your work and time to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith. I need to add this little note about numbers. In this interview, Dr. Schaller uses figures of elemental carbon emissions of all types emitted by humans and in the atmosphere, rather than carbon dioxide only. For example, while I was correct in estimating the current mass of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at around 3,000 gigatons, Schaller sees that as 800 gigatons of elemental carbon, which is also correct. We emit around 30 gigatons of carbon dioxide a year, but scientists consider this as elemental mass of about 8 gigatons. There is no conflict in these numbers, but a different language and perspective. Please see my detailed notes in the Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info, published every Wednesday.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Students first! Students first! Students first! Students first!
You've heard a lot of news about protests in the Arctic. People have been protesting the fact that the Russians are going up with one of the first drilling rigs to grab some more fossil fuels out of the Arctic and make even more ice melt. We have on the line Stephanie Goodwin. She's the BC director for Greenpeace Canada. She's been very active on this file. I met her on the Rainbow Warrior a few nights ago. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you.
So let's get an update. What is happening now with, and how many people are there in this protest?
So we originally had almost, well, a month ago today, four protesters that were trying to get onto Gazprom's oil rig in order to peacefully protest fossil fuel extraction from the Arctic. And what ended up happening was those activists that were trying to get up on the oil rig were arrested, as well as everyone else involved and everyone on board our ship. And that means that there were 28 activists, including, and then a videographer and a photographer, who were all arrested at gunpoint by the Russian military and taken to police detention while they towed our ship to port.
This did happen once before in the early 1990s. Then it was the KGB who dragged a Greenpeace ship in. The protest was against the dumping of nuclear reactors at Nova Zemlya up in the Arctic. Eventually the ship was released and the crew. What is going on now diplomatically? Are the Canadian government getting involved in any way?
Well, our ship, she's called the Arctic Sunrise. She has been seized by the Russian government, and it flies under a Dutch flag. So the Dutch government is following the appropriate channels to intervene with the Russian government to have that ship released. And then in terms of the activists themselves, they are currently under charge of piracy right now, and they are being detained for 2 months while the Russian government conducts an investigation into very, very serious charges of piracy, which our analysis is that it doesn't hold up. That kind of charge does not hold up under Russian or international law, which, you know, Vladimir Putin agrees with us in certain respects on that. And some of the interesting things that have been happening over the last couple of days, because we've been trying to garner as much international support for this as possible, is a few days ago Hillary Clinton said, while she was in England, that she doesn't understand why there isn't already more international outcry towards the Russian government's treatment of these activists and charging them with piracy. And then just yesterday, a number of Nobel Peace laureates collectively wrote a letter, and that includes Desmond Tutu from South Africa, wrote a letter to Vladimir Putin in support of the Arctic 30 and asking for their release. We're not saying that our Arctic 30 aren't willing to face the consequences of their actions. However, we believe in facing reasonable consequences for our reasonable, peaceful actions.
And my understanding is this rig doesn't move. So piracy, you usually think of boarding a ship and taking it over. This is hardly a ship. Can you describe the rig itself?
It's a large oil drilling rig in the Arctic. It's not exactly the same, but if you were to imagine what people can best identify with is if you were to imagine some of the oil rigs a few years ago from the Gulf of Mexico with the BP oil spill. While not exactly similar, you know, it's a rig that looks in some ways in the same ball field as that. And our activists had done this previously. We were just going to board the oil rig and peacefully protest in order to gain attention and to stop the oil drilling so that we could stop the drilling in the Arctic, stop resource extraction in the Arctic so that we can actually start moving in the right direction towards mitigating climate change.
And I believe Greenpeace put out a report suggesting how much greenhouse gases could come out if we go ahead and drill Arctic resources. Do you know about that report?
Well, what we do have is we have an Energy Revolution report, which talks about the degree to which the globe, as well as the Canadians, can get off of fossil fuels and how we can do that over a period of time, over the next 50 years. We're not saying that we're going to eliminate all fossil fuel use over the next 50 years, but we can significantly reduce it so that the kinds of fossil fuels that we'll be using won't include the dirtiest, most dangerous, most expensive kinds, which are Arctic oil drilling, offshore oil and gas drilling, the deep sea stuff, the Alberta tar sands. Those are the most expensive, the most dangerous, and the dirtiest when you consider the full life cycle of the fossil fuel that's being extracted and used at the consumer end.
And one of my concerns, and I'm sure the concerns of millions of people, is what happens if there's a spill up there in the winter? There's no way they're going to be able to clean anything up, is there?
Well, what I know is a few years ago, during the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, I went down to do an on-the-ground investigation. And some of the things I learned were that it's very difficult to clean up an oil spill. Some of the methods that are most pervasively used in cleaning up oil spills are very, very rudimentary. You know, the use of oil booms and that being a primary way of being able to clean up oil is just simply not an effective tool if it doesn't have a whole complement of other tools that can be used. And what I learned down there was that companies consider it a professional success if after an oil spill they're able to clean up 15% of the oil that's spilled. That's 15%. And so when we think about something like the Arctic region, a place that has very little infrastructure, very little support, I would imagine that that success rate for cleanup after an oil spill would be reduced further. And what we know is that there are so many unpredictable variables when it comes to an oil spilling from an offshore oil rig, particularly one in the Arctic, that it quite frankly scares me, the idea that we could potentially be facing an oil spill.
And again, in the Gulf of Mexico, they said a lot of the oil disappeared because there were oil-eating bacteria in those warm waters. Those aren't going to be found in any sort of numbers in the Arctic waters, I wouldn't think.
Well, and in the Gulf of Mexico during that oil spill, one of the things that the government and BP made heavy use of was dispersants, which is a chemical compound that when you put it into the water, it interacts with spilled oil products, and it causes the spilled oil to fall to the floor of the sea. It doesn't actually dissolve or disperse the oil. All it does is it makes it disappear from the surface so that, A, you're not seeing it on the surface, and B, so that it's not hitting landfall, because once it hits landfall, it's more difficult for a company to clean up. However, that doesn't tell us anything about what might be happening on the bottom of the ocean today.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, speaking with Stephanie Goodwin from Greenpeace Canada. And I want to bring out the point, too, that there are a couple of Americans on board, are there?
There are an American on board. There are two Canadians on board as well. Yeah, their nationalities represented, you know, from all over the world. Our crews are notoriously from all over the world. One of our crew, which is the captain, Peter Wilcox, has been sailing Greenpeace ships for decades and was actually the captain of the ship when it was seized by the KGB in the 1990s, and then as well was also on the ship on the very first Rainbow Warrior in 1985 when it was bombed by the French Secret Service, and one of our photographers lost their lives. So he's had quite a bit of experience with dealing with governments who have irrational or with reactions that are disproportionate to the situation.
I ask that because, you know, if somebody grabs an American in the streets of Iran, we hear about it every day on the front pages. It's good that Hillary Clinton has spoken up, but there could be a lot more to be said by all of these countries about their nationals being grabbed. Was that ship in international waters?
Well, the ship was in international waters when it was seized, so that, according to our legal team and legal analysis, is illegal to be seizing a ship in international waters. And my understanding is that, you know, different crew members have had their various governments making diplomatic overtures to the Russian government in order to get their folks released and apply the appropriate amount of pressure. Because it's important for us to remember that our issue is not necessarily with the police. Our issue isn't necessarily with the Russian government. Our issue is with protecting the Arctic. And what we have to remember is that our primary purpose is to protect the Arctic so that space can be kept a healthy and safe ecosystem and provide its maximum contribution to stopping a runaway climate change. And so for us, it's how do we continue to campaign and not stop what we're doing in the face of the kind of absurd charges that we're seeing coming towards the Arctic 30.
And the executive director of Greenpeace International made a very brave proposal, I thought. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Our international executive director, Kumi Naidu, South African man, has sent a letter to Vladimir Putin requesting the release of the 30 detainees and offering as a guarantee that those 30 activists would return for trial. He offered himself. He offered to go and live in Russia himself while the Russian government conducts their investigation and readies themselves for trial. So he's willing to put himself on the line in order so that others can be free today.
What sort of conditions are these people being held in the Arctic 30? Are they in a common Russian jail?
They're being held in a Russian jail. Their conditions vary, but they are receiving, you know, relatively healthy conditions, although details differ depending on who the detainees are, and I don't have specifics on those.
Okay, and the real point behind all this is that this is just early days in this whole Arctic drilling thing. I know Kuminadu was involved in an actual action off of Greenland trying to stop Arctic drilling. The Canadians are hot to trot to get out there. It's going to be a worldwide rush. China's interested. We just can't have this happen. First, the oil industry melts all the ice, and now they want to go in and melt the rest of it.
Yeah, what we know is that we're in it for the long game. We don't think that there is a moment to lose. We don't have a moment to lose in terms of fighting to save our planet, and the urgency couldn't be higher at this point. So for us, we are doing everything we can to get our Arctic 30 out of jail, but not stop our campaigning at all on trying to stop runaway climate change and trying to protect the Arctic. Because what we know now is that the link between democracy and the environmental struggle couldn't be closer. And so everything that we do to protect the Arctic is about being able to generate not just protection for the Arctic, but also opening up that democratic space, because it's through a healthy, robust arena for debate, disagreement, and protest that we can actually arrive at creative solutions to environmental problems that everyone can sign on to. For us, the struggle for both remains really, really clear and really urgent, and we're not stopping either.
Well, Stephanie Goodwin, we have listeners around the world. What can they do to help free the Arctic 30?
Anybody who is concerned about the Arctic 30 and wants to help out can visit our website. You can go to greenpeace.org, and you can go to your relevant country website, and there'll be a take action page, and there are also other opportunities that'll be listed on the webpage as well for communicating with our detainees and for taking action in your own home community. What we know is that today there are a number of actions happening around the world to mark the 1 month anniversary that our activists have been in detention today.
Well, as we wrap up, could you also just tell us about the action that just happened off the decks of the Rainbow Warrior in your city of Vancouver?
Certainly. How do we bring home the kinds of work we've been doing in the Arctic? Well, it's the dirty, dangerous, and expensive fossil fuel production. We have some of that right here in our own backyard, and it's the Alberta tar sands. And what we know in British Columbia on the West Coast is that British Columbia is poised to become a carbon superhighway for transporting the Alberta tar sands, coal, and liquid natural gas. And so yesterday, in order to, with over 130 First Nations opposing the transportation of these kinds of oil products through their territories in British Columbia, and the majority of British Columbians not wanting it, we decided to stand up and take action. Down here in the Lower Mainland around Vancouver, Kinder Morgan is an oil pipeline company that has been shipping oil products from Alberta and other places for quite a number of years, and they've been increasing their importing of bitumen from the Alberta tar sands to export it to Asia. They currently have a proposal to triple their capacity of Alberta tar sands coming to Vancouver's harbor. And what that would equate to is 400 oil tankers coming into our harbor a year. For us, that is an untenable position. So yesterday morning, 16 activists went into the facility, the Kinder Morgan facility, and shut it down for the day. They shut it down by locking themselves to the front gate. They shut it down by getting up on two of their big container tanks and off of one of the tanks hanging a large banner, sending a direct message to Prime Minister Stephen Harper saying, "Harper, no tar sands pipeline." On the other tank, activists painted on it, "Stop tar sands." And then down near the docking facility, because this is where big tankers come up to the dock and load up with tar sands bitumen, we had four activists down there blocking the dock, two of them climbing up on pipes and being ready to spend the night if necessary in order to send a clear message that the expansion of the tar sands is not on.
And listeners, what you have to realize is that Vancouver is one of the busiest ports. It is the busiest port in Canada, and it's gorgeous. People come from all over the world to visit it. Just one of these tankers, if it crashes or gashes open full of bitumen, the stuff sinks to the bottom. There's no way to clean it up. You can't put booms around it. What are you going to do, drain the whole harbor and then scrape the bottom with machines? It's just absolutely insane to be doing this. So I'm hoping people will get on board to stop that as well. We've been talking with Stephanie Goodwin from Greenpeace Canada. Thank you so much for your time.
Great. Thanks very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
When will this insanity end?
Get links to follow up on today's interviews in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Find out how to support this program at our website, ecoshock.org. Download a ton of free MP3s while you're there. Pass them out far and wide. We're out of time. Thank you for listening. I'm Alex Smith.